right, cool. Well, welcome to the CMC podcast on bailout systems. I'm your host today, Kelly Byrne, and with me is Leroy Harbach from CMC Rescue and Dale Peckle from Wauwatosa, Wisconsin. So it's a two-on-one of Midwestern accents to an East Coaster. So we'll have to try and deal with it. But Leroy, how you doing this evening?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing A-okay. Dale, everything good in your world?
Kelly, outstanding. Really appreciate the invite to join you guys. I'm excited to participate in the discussion.
Totally. So, like, we're talking about bailout systems, and I mean, speaking from a personal note, you know, Dale, you have put out a tremendous amount of videos on bailout and firefighter rescue stuff. I know you've got a YouTube channel. And I counted today. Do you know how many YouTube videos you have on firefighter rescue kind of stuff?
Yeah, I want to say it's...
Have you ever counted?
It's around 100 right now, I think. It's
101.
101.
Yeah, you got... That's nuts. Yeah, totally. 101 YouTube videos. I counted. That's insane. It's just a ton of output and loads and loads and loads of good information. Again, if anybody listening, I totally encourage you to go to his YouTube channel and check it out. Are you present anywhere other than YouTube? I know we're social media friends,
yeah,
but do you have a website or anything you need to plug?
I don't have a specific website, Kelly. I share a lot of my stuff and I'll embed stuff on like Fire Engineering and other websites. I do a lot of correspondence with people, probably mostly through Facebook and personal email, but,
cool. Okay. Yeah,
nothing specifically geared just toward me besides a YouTube.
Okay. And all the new people that come to my firehouse, I point them to your channel, your, bailout prop, like we've built at the firehouse. My fire department's built, 6 or 7 of them off of the plans you shared. I mean, 10 years ago, we got, a couple of them travel around to the different battalions so people can, practice writ stuff and bailout stuff. It's interesting. Like you'll never see it unless you come to DC, but like it's been a big impact there, especially from a training standpoint. So, on a personal note, thank you for that. So
I appreciate it.
101. Totally. 101 YouTube videos, loads of great content. You're, in Wauwatosa, Wisconsin. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a suburb of Milwaukee. So Milwaukee's the biggest city in Wisconsin, and we're a suburb of them and participate in shared service responses with them.
Right on. And you are, how long have you been there?
29 years, almost exactly.
Holy cow. You know, I see your countdown you post on social media. How many tours you got left?
Yeah, I'm in the upper 60s. So I'm closing into the twilight for sure. But it's been a good run.
Totally. Again, like your free sharing of information is pretty cool. Like I know it's influenced a lot of people and, probably more than you'll ever know. So which is good stuff. So we're talking about bailout systems. Like what was your first exposure to a bailout system? Did you read about it in a magazine? Did some senior man show it to you? What was your first exposure to it?
Yeah, that's a great question, Kelly. I actually got first started with firefighter survival, firefighter rescue, rapid intervention training back in 1994, kind of at the directive of my volunteer fire chief at the time. A very progressive guy, I would say, kind of ahead of the curve. And he wanted to improve procedures, techniques, have specific equipment to safeguard firefighters while operating on the fire ground. And if you guys know, you both have been in the industry for a long, long time, firefighter safety survival, RIT was really in its infancy back in the early 1990s. So it was non-existent. I mean, you go on the internet now and you type in any one of those buzzwords and you're going to get thousands and thousands of hits, whether it's articles or videos. But back then, sure, there really wasn't much. We really had to do a lot of digging. I was kind of tasked with spearheading a lot of that. So we came up with operating guidelines, specific equipment, and all sorts of procedures that went hand in hand with both. And that kind of I guess, pushed me into more of the survival component. We always used to tell guys, if you're going to be part of a RID, a rapid intervention team, or a FAST, firefighter assistance search team, you got to have your own shit together before you want to go in and try to rescue someone else. And safety, survival, self-survival skills really has to come before RIT. Because if you look at statistics, most firefighters are either able to self-extricate, or firefighters that are in the immediate area or vicinity where the mayday is transmitted go in and provide aid. And the RITs are backup when both of those fail. So we were hardcore into rapid intervention procedures probably until like 98, I would say. And then we start to realize, hey, what can happen to firefighters? Like what are things that we don't have in place? And one of them was bailout systems. And back then, there were certified escape belts. I think the gut belt was probably one of the first commercially made belts that was available. But back then, I would say mid-90s to latter 90s, all we did for self-extrication or bailing out beyond a ladder bail or a hang and drop technique was a piece of webbing or a piece of rope. And back then we would teach guys how to do, you know, friction body belays or body repels. That kind of graduated into using a carabiner. And then the mini eights, mini friction control devices came out and it started to evolve from there. But that's where I started. And it actually happened on an acquired structure where a student of mine, when we were doing a RIT class, is like, okay, well, the ladder bail is great. This hang and drop's great, but you know, what if you're above an area where a ladder can't reach you, a ladder isn't available? What if you're on a roof and you got to jump and the height is beyond what you think you can survive? What's your option? And we were like, wow, yeah, that's a great question. And we carried webbing in our pocket and some guys carried sections of rope. And that's where we started. But we started to realize that this wasn't enough. We had to look at the technique more seriously. So that's really where the launching pad was for me. I would say probably 97, 98, we started really researching it. And I would say 98, 99, we started having something formally in place. And beyond that, you guys know the big one that was probably the launching pad for the evolutions of escape systems was the FDNY incident in the Bronx on January 23rd, 2005, where four firefighters from Truck 27 and two from Rescue 3 got trapped. That's really, I think, what really started pushing things forward. For me, I think, you know, without getting too in-depth with it, Kelly, it was that incident was hit us pretty hard because myself and fellow instructors that I taught with at the time, we were teaching how to use escape systems to rescue a civilian and fellow firefighter years before that incident happened. And if you remember, I think it was just Jeff Cool that had a system. And he ended up sharing it with Joey DiBernardo. And Joey pretty much ultimately sacrificed himself for Jeff, took anchor of that system to get Jeff out first, you know, knowing that he had a family and Joey was single. Pretty heroic action just in itself. Sure. But yeah, we were teaching techniques how you could use a system to get a fellow firefighter out and then still follow up with getting yourself out. And the fact that that wasn't mainstream, that you, we weren't able to get the word out, that's where the YouTube pursuits came in for me. I was like, we gotta somehow mainstream this stuff and get more people involved. And that's the advantage of social media now, is you can correspond with people across the planet. And get this info out. And that's kind of a brief, in-depth history of how things got started.
Right. No, that's excellent. And when you started off making procedures and figuring out how you guys were going to do it, you know, in that 94 to 97 time frame, I mean, I guess I was all just trial and error. Yeah, like, because if there's really nothing else out there, like, you're just... Is that what you guys did? Like, just try it. If it works, great. If not, throw it out.
Yeah. You know, our joke used to be, it's not like somebody, you know, this stuff's invented when you wake up with some magical dream and it comes in your head. But in a way, in some respects it does. Somebody has to start, right? Somebody has to try a technique, whether it's extrication, technical rest. So you got to try it, see if it works. And there was a lot of trial and error. You know, we came up before the hooks, the anchor hooks came on the market and became literally, I would think, a critical component of the system now. And that's what came out of FDNY. The guys realized, hey, they lost their tools. If you lose your tools and you don't have a substantial object to secure to, you need something. And that's where that Crosby hook started, and it just evolved from there. But, you know, we came up with a technique called the tool in the wall. And I ended up writing an article for Fire Chief Magazine, and it got out that way. And we shared it on Billy Goldfeather's site, firefighterclosecalls.com, and then made some videos on that. And before the hooks came out, it was probably one of the next best techniques to a substantial object, and it's still a viable technique today, if you fully understand the pros and cons of it. But that was a total trial and error. I remember when we were first playing around with that on acquired structure, we were like, is this going to work? And it was pretty amazing to find out how strong it actually was.
I mean, everything's cool as long as you have a belay line, right? Like, were you guys doing belay lines, I imagine? Were you starting low level, first floor?
We were first thing, we were going out of second floor windows once we started feeling comfortable. And you and Leroy obviously are being rope rescue gurus that you guys are. It's probably not as big of an issue, but for us lay people, jumping out a window head first didn't seem like the greatest idea on a small piece of rope or webbing, you know? So it was, belay line or not, it was intimidating. But it was, we took all the safety precautions, obviously. We're not stupid.
No, and it's always incremental, right? Like you start to, you dip a toe in the water before you cannonball in usually. So it's like, all right, first floor, I can do this 10 or 15 times, feels good. And eventually you're at the second floor and like, oh, how the hell did I get up here?
Right. And that was part of the evolution of that bailout wall, that firefighter training window prop was, what can you do? If you look at probably the most critical components, and Leroy and I have always talked about this, it's not necessarily the rappel or the slide, right? Because you're out of the environment at that time. That becomes a little bit more critical if you got fellow firefighters need to bail out after you and you need to open up an avenue for them to exit. But once you're out, you could chill there for a while, and especially with the evolutions of rope fibers now and what they can withstand for heat. But it's securing your anchor quickly, attaching to your system if it's not pre-attached or integrated, and negotiating the window, negotiating your exit. That was a critical component, and the bailout wall kind of facilitated that. You could not have to worry about a belay line getting in your way. You can practice those three components, load your system and cycle through that repetitively without the threat of serious injury.
Absolutely. And in the room, in the sitting room of the firehouse, you can set this thing up if you wanted to, and breaks down into fit in the bed of a long bed pickup. So, excellent prop. Is there a place people can find that prop other than just looking at it on YouTube? Have you ever gone over that thing in depth? I know you've.
I wish I was a little bit more internet and tech savvy, but I'm not. So typically what I do is I share my personal email through various social media sites. Yep. And anyone that wants it, I mean, pretty much everything I have is open game. I don't charge for anything. Sure. I don't make any money on any of my videos. If they want to make a request, they can send it to my email, which is FFDPEC. That's F as in Frank, F as in Frank again, D as in David, P as in Paul, E as in Edward, K as in Kansas. So again, that's basically FFDPEC, myself abbreviated, and that's at AOL.com. And I'll send everybody the plans that we have for the entire prop, which includes a Denver hallway, it includes pitch roof attachment, and they can go nuts with it. They can modify it however they want. It's worked out really great for a lot of departments. And then through social media, I've been very, very fortunate. I've been able to share the plans literally worldwide. I know I'm into the thousands already. I haven't really kept count, but Japan, Russia, Germany, Australia, Great Britain. I can't think of a place where I don't think I've sent them. I know every state in the union, definitely in the U.S. I've sent it out, and it's a good feeling that it's benefited guys and gals in the fire service, and I hope it will continue to do so.
I think it will, especially if anybody looks at it. I encourage you to email Dale and get a copy of that. I mean, that's how we got it at work. Like, we're, you know, and probably 10 years ago, or I don't know, maybe not that long, but pretty close to that. One of my buddies emailed you sent him the plans, and we built it, and, you know, again, it's out there. So, and it's an awesome, awesome prop. So I encourage you to do that. Leroy, what was your first exposure to bailout? I mean, we're still on that. Is that around the same time frame kind of deal there?
Yeah, well, a little bit earlier, and a lot of that just had to do with, I mean, with the context, right, in the industry, still being on the job. One of my first bosses was really adamant, you know, carry a chunk of rope, carry some webbing, all that kind of stuff. Of course, nobody ever told me what I'm supposed to be doing with it.
Secondary.
So you kind of figure it out. I mean, and the first rope I used to carry was when we'd have the horses.
Yeah, right.
And we'd go out and we'd pull the horse tail and then, you know, weave rope together. Now, it actually, the first really formal stuff that I got as far as formal education, other than testing gravity and doing stupid things, is down at in Illinois at a bunch of guys from Chicago taught the class, Chicago, Schaumburg, a few other places that actually taught the kind of along those same lines as RIT. But they also addressed firefighter rescue and then bailout as a portion of the class. Sure. So it was probably around that same, it was late 80s, okay. You know, right around in there, you know, 87, 88, somewhere around in there. When you look at the fire service, typically, that's really when education kind of, somebody put it on the radar screen, if you will.
Yeah.
And normally, normally it's like Dale said, you know, there's a catastrophic event, and then suddenly it's number one on the radar screen.
Most important thing, and like it kind of,
it
definitely kind of, it definitely got there after 2005. Yeah, I remember looking through my dad's magazines, fire engineering magazines, by the way, and there was some bailout stuff, and there was my first exposure to it. I remember, like, you know, the rope slide, you know, somebody anchors a floor above, you know, who that is. I don't know. How'd they transition the windowsill in a burning condition to get the rope slide, you know, who knows. But, that was definitely my first exposure to it. And then my rope geek side started spinning up. I was later to the game than both of you, but probably 2003 or four, I definitely started, getting hot and heavy into it. I did a presentation in 2010 for the International Technical Rescue Symposium called the Defenestration Sensation.
Yeah, and I remember reading that article looking too, Kelly.
Oh, right on. Yeah, it was a fun one to research. It was a lot of, just a lot of guys at work helped me with that. And, my shift just messing around in vacant acquired structures. But part of it, I looked at the history of bailouts. And aside from that fire engineering magazine, I found, you know, Leroy, you mentioned Chicago, and you know, maybe the Midwest was leading it here in the States. Probably in the 1950s, they had a hose or a rope slide type of evolution as well. I thought that was the first kind of bailout thing that, you know, was in print. And then a couple months ago, my buddy sent me a London Fire Brigade training thing from 1876. And they're doing all kinds of gnarly, like everything we think is, you know, cool and new and firefighter rescue and assisting guys from the roof. Like 1876, London was doing it and wrote it down. Like there's nothing new in the world, you know, it just got lost for a little while and somebody rediscovered it, which I can't remember the name of that thing to save my life, but it's a London Fire 1876, something or other. So if anybody wants to go find the history of it, I'll, you know, hopefully we'll post a link in the show notes to it. Do you remember like your first like solid kit, Dale? This is it. Like I've gone through, a bunch of iterations. We've trained, you know, the crawl, walk, run thing, and like I've ended up at this, you know, 50 feet of rope with a carabiner. Like, do you remember what your first kit was?
Oh, There's been such an evolution, Kelly, of makeshift components. In fact, that's really how Leroy and I got connected. Was I was brought to a local vocational college in Waukesha County. It was Waukesha County Technical College, and they wanted to put together a firefighter rescue survival rapid intervention curriculum, and I was brought on board to do that. And while we were putting together the training facility and getting equipment, that's how we got in contact with Leroy, who was, he's kind of the guru in the area on his career department, had his own rope rescue business. And, you know, we purchased a lot of equipment from him. And I want to say the really, the first official kit was just a nylon 7.5 millimeter rope. I can't remember if it was PMI or not. I don't remember the manufacturer because so long ago now. And then it was a couple of different types of friction controlled eights. I think one was the SMC. I think another one was like the RQ3. I think we had the PMI PED, you know, with carabiners.
Yeah.
And that you could attach to a certified escape belt. And then we had, we basically had what we referred to as a quick loop or a figure eight on a bite that would allow us to do the tool in the wall technique. And we had a carabiner on that. And that was probably our first system, not commercially made, mind you. It was all certified components, but from different manufacturers. That was probably the first system that we, I guess, promoted and used in training. And again, that would have been, that would have been the late 1990s.
So are you still a, this is another question I've written down. Are you still, are you an escape belt guy or are you a, harness in the pants kind of guy?
You know, it's probably going to be difficult for the listeners to understand, but I actually have both. My turnout gear on my career FD is set up in a manner where we can actually route a belt through the pant loops of our turnout pants. And one of our chief officers came up with a belt almost off of similar to CMC's duty belt design with the Cobra belt. But it, this one's 100% Kevlar. Each member of our department is issued that. And that's what we attach our system to. Before that, I was what I refer to as independent. Basically, I had carried my system, but I had to connect it when I was getting ready to bail out. Now, most of our members, including myself, are integrated or what we call pre-attached, having our system pre-attached to the belt. And that works really, really well with the belt in our pants. I guess I always tell people there's three options, right? There's a certified belt on the outside of your coat, which is probably the least comfortable, but also probably the least expensive, commercially made setup.
Least comfortable to hang in or just to wear around?
Yeah, I think to hang from, in my opinion. Because everything's around your waist, right? And you have no bone structure there.
Yep.
You're below your rib cage. Then the next best is a belt and a pants, which is more on your hip. So you got some bone structure support. And then probably the most comfortable is the seat harness. That's usually how we promote it through people. But it's also as you, I guess, how do you want to say it, evolve through those options, the price goes up.
Yeah.
Typically. Yep. But I have a makeshift webbing harness that I wear in my turnout gear on my paid on call department, and I have a more of a commercially made Kevlar belt that's in my pants on my career FD. And again, both systems are pre-attached or integrated. So pretty much pull your hook out, I'm ready to go.
Nice. That's absolutely. That ended up being a the you know, my prime directive when I started looking out bailout kits myself. Leroy, were you a belt guy or a harness in the pants kind of guy when you were still on the fire department before you retired?
Well, I was a belt guy, and because harnesses in the pants didn't exist.
It's a good reason for not having
them. They had harness. Well, yeah, you know, it was kind of my first clue. They do call me Captain Obvious for a reason. But the because the only other option that was out there at the time. really? All right. Note to self.
It's just it's a testament to your experience.
No, because the only other
that's what it is.
The only It's that horsetail. It's that horsetail rope. The only other option that was out there was an external harness. Yeah. And the Gemtor type of harness was really the only other option that was out there at the time. And the belt to me was convenient.
Yeah.
But I did wear it on the outside, and yeah, it's not a comfortable ride. I mean, it's
agreed. So I'm a belt guy myself. I like that I can switch it between my different sets of gear. If my first set of gear gets dirty, I can remote anchor it if I'm being really geeky. But mostly it's just like I can wear it on the calls I need it and not on the calls I don't. But it is like way uncomfortable to hang in. But I do like the way just, wearing it around every day, it rides naturally on my hips. I always felt like, somebody put a dumbbell in my pants pocket with the, a pants based system. So, Dale, I think you said you got an improvised harness, like a Swiss seat, right? With 1-inch webbing between your liner and your shell. Is that something you did a while ago?
Yeah, that was quite a while ago. So, it was exactly what Leroy said. There really wasn't a lot of options out there. And they were expensive. I think that Gemtor is still, what is it, Leroy? It's got to be around 200 or more, 225 for that harness.
Oh, to be honest with you, I don't even know.
Yeah, it's up there.
It's a lot. I'll tell you, we had a fire at work. We were going as the second rescue squad. We had, reports of people, jumping from the whatevereth floor. And we didn't have any, we had our belt-based harnesses, me and my partner in crime. And when we got back, he ended up seeing your video and he's like, oh crap, I have got to do that. So even to this day, he still got his bailout belt. And then the 1-inch webbing in between the shell and the liner, just in case we got to, do the roof lower or something along those lines. We've got something slightly more comfortable. In general, I know I'm a belt guy, but, I might be in the minority, but I like it. I'm a fan of it. We talked a half a second before we started recording. One of the things, I got this, note thing in my notes here. Do you think there's a negative connotation, Dale, about the term bailout kit? We had guys in where I work call them quitter pants. We had integrated systems in our pants, and they're like, what is bailing out? That's just not a term we use. The thought was, hey, put the fire out and the problem goes away, which is great until the fire doesn't go out, whatever problems you got. But I think they fail to see the usefulness to other firemen or civilians. So, I know you're pretty hot on that. You want to talk a little bit about, maybe other uses, of a bailout kit, or have you heard negative terms from bailout? The term?
No, I have. And I think Leroy would agree. And he's been doing this for a long time as well, and been dealing with departments and trying to educate them on that. And it's, I think, even though we've come a long way, Kelly, it's still a relatively new concept for some people. And that really highly aggressive firefighter, yes. I remember one of our guys who left after a year. He was on Detroit. He came to our department. He was actually an intern for us. Detroit let off a bunch of firefighters. He started with us, was on my crew. He was my cub for about a year. And he ended up going back in Detroit. And when he went back, we gave him a system. The crew put together some money. And as a going away gift, we gave him a system. And I remember him getting back in touch with me. And they're like, what are you doing, kid? if you get trapped, we're just going to throw you out before you even deploy that. And he was trying to educate them, and it was a completely new concept to them. And yes, I would agree. To some firefighters, there was a negative connotation that went with it. That bailout, you're quitting, you're bailing out. And I think what firefighters seem to understand is we always try to educate them in this respect. You can do everything perfectly on the fire ground from a strategical and tactical standpoint, and something can still go wrong. It might not be a catastrophic event.
Sure.
It might be a series of small events that adds up to the straw that broke the camel's back analogy. But Murphy's Law can bite us at any time. And the point is having a contingency plan. And sometimes the most aggressive firefighters are the ones that get into trouble. Okay? You don't have to be a brand new rookie to get into a difficult or challenging or life and death situation. And when you're pushing the envelope to save a life, which is what we are expected to do, okay? And that's where a lot of these firefighters get in trouble. I can tell you the two incidents in the city of Milwaukee, which is, again, my neighboring department that we respond with. They've had two incidents where firefighters have gotten trapped when they were aggressively searching for the report of trapped occupants. And they push ahead of the fire, and something went wrong. So it's trying to educate firefighters that, listen, it's not only to get yourself out, but you have to realize with the cost of these systems, many departments cannot issue all their personnel a system. So you look at, from that standpoint, we look at, okay, if you're one of those departments that doesn't issue their members their own system or even one for a riding position, but you have invested in one yourself, you need to realize that they can get trapped. They can run out of air. They could be in a bad situation where they need to get out. You can't wait for a ladder. You can't negotiate the interior conditions. You can get them out with your system and still follow out and get yourself out. And then you add into the element of the civilian rescue. If you're trapped personally in a situation where you can't get out, well, you're certainly not going to take a conscious civilian down through the interior when they're not going to be able to survive the conditions that you can with your personal protective ensemble, your breathing apparatus, your turnout gear. So if we need to get them out in a hurry, we can use our system. So I think slowly, Kelly, that's starting to change when firefighters look at it from that standpoint that, hey, we may need to push through an unviable area to get to a more viable one to facilitate a rescue. And by doing so, we may get trapped. I know Leroy is very familiar with this because he worked with the guys from Yonkers, but I think it was Patrick Joyce. I can't remember how to pronounce his last name, but that was October 2nd of 2009. He was a rescue company on Rescue One. Yep. They had a report of civilians trapped, and his company, they beelined up to try to get to these victims that were reported trapped, and the fire rapidly evolved and trapped them to the point where they had to jump. It's an example. And the Milwaukee incidents that I was referring to, we had, I think the first one that happened was an engine company. It wasn't even a truck company or a rescue company. It was an engine company who had a hose line and lost pressure. And they were making their way up to an attic where they had reported two kids trapped. And for whatever reason, they lost pressure on the line. They got forced to the attic windows. Conditions deteriorated. They both had to jump. They ended up falling onto a first floor roof. So they fell about 12 to 13 feet. Thankfully, neither one was killed, but they were seriously injured, burned and broken bones. It's these things happen so fast, Kelly. It's again, I look at it as it's not a weakness to carry one. In fact, I look at it, if you're carrying one, you are highly progressive and probably a very, very aggressive firefighter as well, and you understand what they can do for you. They understand what the system can do for you, your fellow firefighters, and even help you make a grab.
I agree. I had a chief several years ago. He thought of the unit I was on as a, he called it a forward deployed RIT team, which I mean that term alone sparked a whole ton of thought. Like, so I'm a fireman who's also a rope geek. Like, if you give me 50 feet of rope, an anchor device, and a friction device, like, I can own the world. Like, I can, you know, trap civilian, trap fireman.
Yeah, you and Leroy both.
Yeah. Like, you give a rope nerd fireman that kind of equipment, and there's nothing you can't do. So, but that term, forward deployed RIT, just it sparked a whole. I'm going on probably 12 or 13 years of trying to expand that. I got a whole, thesis I'm working on that. But I think that if people think of it in those terms, like, you know, how would you get, a firefighter out of a window? We've been doing, at work, these, evolutions with rope and a ladder above a window. So, I guess similar to the Denver drill, how would you use rope and a ladder as a high point to get a guy out.
Right.
And we've actually swapped at work. We've swapped our halyards out for some nerdy stuff. But I mean, a guy with an escape kit can, you know, help raise a victim from the interior and lower him down safely outside. You can do below grade, you know, the, you know, a couple guys with either webbing or escape kits can do, you know, below grade stuff. But, you know, to your point, like once guys start seeing the usefulness, I think you can be, you know, you can be more useful on the fire ground. It's not just one person out one window one time. Like it's a, you know, it's a Swiss Army knife in your pocket, I suppose.
Absolutely.
Yeah, totally. Leroy, forward deployed RIT team thoughts. Have you run into any of that? You know, you travel around the country teaching. Have you seen guys pushing the envelope with that? Or
actually, yeah, I just got back a couple of weeks ago from an East Coast city, which just bugs me. That you know, no offense, but
none taken,
you know,
none taken. It wasn't where I work. I'm okay.
No, but it was refreshing. I was in there working with guys that are going to be training new guys. Was there for 4 days. And to me, it was very refreshing because their company officers had been training their guys to think out of the box. Now, everybody on the department is issued a system, but they had already looked at and were pretty competent with some of the other uses and techniques. I mean, so for me, it was a simple class. I showed them a few extra things. Then they kind of went, oh, man, I never even thought of that. Yeah. That's really cool. But organizationally, they looked at it when, like, commercial systems first started coming out. They go, we have high rises. We have all of – and it's a highly densely populated
city. Yeah.
With a lot of old, you know, typical East Coast type of construction. You know, I mean, as far as age of the buildings, that definitely kind of thing. And I mean, because the high rises are all new. It's the residentials that are, you know, usually pretty beat up. It's the
5-story apartments that are going to get you.
Yeah. And that, and they have a plethora of them. Nice big word, one. Right?
Lots of syllables.
which is pretty good for me. I'm usually pretty monosyllabic. It was refreshing to me because their truck companies, which is all these guys were on trucks with a couple of exceptions. I think they had some squad guys there as well. And they said, hey, man, we look at these things as not only for us, but it's for everybody else as
definitely
well. Which is huge. You know, you can't lose sight of the bigger picture.
No, you can't. And that's, I mean, you know, one of the things, I guess, to be a little bit of a shill here, like I know I had been asking for like the hook of the system to be rated as a descender, you know, as a descent control device. And the new, recently re-released bailout systems have the hook is rated as a descent control device, as an emergency descent control device. So you can use the tail end of the, of your escape kit to weave it through the hook or wrap it around with the gated hook and use it, you know, as an on-label use to lower somebody. And Dale, like a lot of that is, you know, thanks to your YouTube videos. And I know you gave me credit in there for it. And, you know, I'd have to share it with my guys at work, but like, it's funny, you know, you graciously gave me credit and, you know, everybody calls me like, oh, hey, look at it. Check this out. It's like, oh, Dale's, that guy's the one pushing it. But like,
rightfully so, you know, Leroy, you know, once Leroy and I finally connected beyond just the equipment and marketing, he's been instrumental. You know, I can't say enough good things about him. You know, he's definitely helped us evolve. And your technique, again, out of FDNY, the hook became an instrumental piece of equipment or a key component in the system, Kelly. And then when they started incorporating the hitching slots, and then again, the rope nerd in you took it to another level. We look at your technique again. I sometimes refer to it as so you don't burn technique.
I like that.
Just a play on words, but it's you know, without humor intended, it's that's what it is. Okay, let's get down to it. It's to get yourself and a victim out. You can be in that situation where you're not in an anchor friendly environment. You're in an anchor limited environment or a non-existent anchor environment. You don't have a tool. There's no substantial object. It's an all masonry building. Your hook is your last resort. So if you look at that hook as a last resort for yourself, having the ability to use it as a descender to get somebody out and follow suit with getting yourself out, it's a game changer, man. And you know, that technique, and then what we refer to as primary deployment, or just using your anchor end and attaching that to the victim, you pair both those together, you're covering all your options. You really are. You're covering all your bases. And I think that forward deployed writ, I've heard it before. I love the terminology. Again, we used to say, hey, if you're gonna if you're gonna put a writ together, or a FAST, firefighter assistant search team, I know East Coast uses that terminology a lot. You'd want that to be your Navy SEALs, your Army Rangers, you know, your Delta Force of firefighters, right? But on the same note, do you want to have your best firefighters standing around outside waiting for something to happen? You want your best firefighters in the game. You want them putting the fire out, doing your searches. And if you got them interior with options, it's one thing, Kelly, let's face it, to have technique and procedures. But it's... Yep. I know Navy SEAL used to tell me, if, you know, give the guy a K-bar knife, just like you said, give you and Leroy a piece of rope and some carabiners, and there's nothing you can't do. But that is limited. The more equipment you have, the better that equipment is, the more versatile that it's configured and set up, the more options you have. And if you got those firefighters on the interior with those capabilities, that's who I want with me, or interior with me. So if something goes wrong, you can deal with it, because you can't just snap your fingers and magically a wire cutters appears to get you out of an entanglement situation. You can't magically snap your fingers and have an escape system at your disposal for all the techniques you just mentioned. You got to carry that equipment and you got to know how to deploy it. I think those are those components go hand in hand.
And they do. And I think you just got to train on it like a lot, and you got to fail a bunch in training, figure out what's going to fail you in your, you know, like what techniques won't you try, you know, when it comes time for it. Like there's a lot of techniques we tried that just didn't work. And like, I'm okay with that. And it sounds like, you know, that your progressive chief who kind of tasked you with the bailout stuff, you know, we've never worked together, obviously, but like, it seems like it would be a good training environment. You know, like if you were able to develop these systems back then and techniques, I would imagine you were free to just try and fail without, you know, ridicule. I think that's a big part of the training. Like, you know, where I work, the culture is not, you know, I'm speaking for my shift. Like if we tried something and it doesn't work, like nobody gets bummed out about it. You're like, all right, well, screw it. Like I'm never going to try that way when somebody's skin's melting off, you know, like it's okay. I think that the training, failing, training and succeeding is a huge part of that. And just, you know, keep driving on. I know a lot of, you know, a lot of the YouTube videos that you put out and watching them, you know, there's some very specific stuff in there about how to, you know, wind your webbing or, you know, pack your rope back into your escape kit. Like, you know, that all comes from trial and error, and just, you know, a 7-minute YouTube video doesn't show you the, you know, 20 hours you spent trying to figure it out. But,
you know, I told Leroy this once, Kelly, it's guys would ask me, hey, you got a blooper video? I'm like, I have so many bloopers. I could have a multi-hour blooper video. And I kind of wish I would have saved all of it, because it'd probably get more views than anything else I got on the online. But you're right. We try not to put out a video where there's a bunch of mistakes, but what's that analogy? The master has failed many more times than the student has ever tried. Or attempted. It's absolutely it's a true statement. I mean, if you want to look halfway decent on video, you can bet your ass that there is a lot of stumbles and fumbles before it looked halfway decent. And that's the goal. It's to try to show people, you know, how fast can you do this? If you looked at everything that we do on the fire ground, and you can look at this from a special or technical rescue standpoint too, right? There's there's four factors that we try to achieve: speed, efficiency, effectiveness, and able to do it with some margin of safety. If you can cover those four elements in anything that you do, then you are, I like to say, micro critiquing the tactic, but that's how you achieve excellence. That's how you strive for perfection. And you need to do that. And from a bailout standpoint, that's the subject we're on. Let's face it. If you look at all the Mayday parameters that you can think of, I look at, there's two worst case scenarios. Getting caught in a collapse where you're pinned, either in debris, rubble, wires, whatever it may be, and there's nothing that you can do to get yourself out. You're just waiting for your fellow firefighters to come find you and get you out, and just hoping the fire won't involve the room or compartment you're in, and you got enough air to buy you enough time for someone to provide aid, and being trapped on an upper floor. The problem with being trapped on an upper floor is you literally may only have seconds to get out. Not enough time to even transmit your mayday. So if you don't have your shit together, let's face it, you're just carrying a system you never practice with it, and you never practice to be fast. Chances are, when you're pushed in that type of situation or parameter, you're not going to execute it very well. If you train to be fast in everything that you do, it's always easy to gear down and do it slower. But that's what we try to tell people in training: is look at everything that you do, look at every piece of equipment from that vantage point or viewpoint, those four elements. And if you can satisfy all of them, then you're on the right track.
Totally agreed. And you know, at some point you got to do the full combat speed training. You know, and that, like, that's rough. I mean, jumping out of a window once, is, you know, is rough on the body. Doing it, you know, 20 times in a day is definitely rough. Have you ever injured yourself while doing the bailout training?
Oh, yeah, unfortunately I have. I think the speed, actually, I remember seeing one video from you, Kelly, that you posted, training with the DC guys, and I can't remember what system it was, but you're basically standing out the window, and in literally seconds, you're out the window and reverted, negotiating your descent. And it was like, damn, that was fast.
Yeah.
And I use that video to show guys, hey, listen, you guys, to think that you have no time to deploy a system. If you go through the same mechanics of how you would bail out, Leroy and I talked about this many times. If you're negotiating the windowsill to do a hang and drop, you look at FDNY as a prime example. You're trying to get out the window and then drop feet first. Not too many people are diving out like Superman, okay? Because you know, if you do a face plant, it could be game over. So you're trying to drop feet first. But if you look at that, those mechanics, you can be out the window literally, and especially with the new hooks, and revert starting your descent in seconds. That was, I think, where the speed component came to play for us. And that video is still, I know it's still out there, but that was, I think, the one that really pushed us forward to say, hey, look how quick you can do this.
Nice. Cool. Yeah. That was a vacant acquired structure a million years ago. I use it in one of my presentations, but it was 4.5 seconds from the time I grabbed my hook till the time I was totally out of the window. And that was with an old NARS hook, one of the first ones with the hitching slot and and an escape artist descender.
Yeah, now I remember it. I couldn't remember what the hook was, but yeah, that NARS RPI. Yep.
Yeah.
That was it.
Yeah. But, yeah, big.
That's a great
thing.
Video, though, man.
What you don't see in, dude, that's funny. Like, I didn't know that anybody. I don't know. I know it's out there on YouTube. I didn't know anybody else ever watched it. But it was, what you don't see in that video. I was scared to death to let go of that hook. Like, my hand was it did not feel like it was holding on that windowsill. I was like, hey, you know, it's now or never. And actually, I switched up belayers right before the video. I had we had a belay from like two rafters, you know, just a 2-point piece of webbing with a carabiner and a monther hitch. And I asked a guy to belay me. And it, like, after the fifth try of trying to tie the monther hitch, I was like, you know what? Like, why don't you hold the camera, buddy? And I'll let the other guy do it. So I was waiting to die on that one, but luckily it turned out good and it's cool. Like, it was definitely we've been working on it for quite some time, trying to build that speed up. So, yeah, what you see is like the, you know, the 5,000th bailout I'd ever practiced, but it, you know, it looked good in that, you know, 4.5 seconds. So, I'm glad it worked for you. But yeah, injuries while training, like it's usually,
back on stuff inside of your arm. You know, I probably the worst one I had was a couple years ago. We, in my area, we provide the option for escape system training. It's really the only formal structured escape system class that I know of, at least in our area. And it's a two-part program. It's what we call level one, which is all self-rescue techniques. Students go through everything. It's an 8-hour class, either a full day or 2 days broken down into 4-hour sessions. And then we do another class, which is advanced systems. And that's another 8 hours. So the whole program is 16 hours if you do level one and two. We were at a department out west doing a level two, basically how to use systems for advanced self-rescue and how to use the systems for victim rescue, Kelly. And one of the techniques that Leroy and I have talked about this is, and you touched on it. It's, you have to evolve to different levels with bailouts. If you want to try to master this, it can't be just a 30-inch wide window, okay, with a projected sill plate. Yeah. And something that's easy to negotiate. You have to look at every component that's involved, from how to take out the window, techniques for that. And we put a couple videos out on that. But that's a key element. You know, how quickly can you break out the window? Do you know when to break out the window? I mean, you need to compartmentalize first. You need to make sure your whole team's in place first, right? And then you take out the window and get your weakest link out first if you can, so you don't leave them behind. Well, yep. You don't always have the perfect window. Sometimes you have a window that's 3, 4, 5 feet off the ground. You know, what are the techniques for negotiating that window sill if you don't have a piece of furniture to stand on? What if you have that narrow window? And we have windows in my response district that are less than 17 inches. And for a big dude, and I'm not a big dude, but if you're in a worst case scenario and you have to deploy your hook, you got to keep a hand inside, right? Until that hook is loaded. Before you let go of it. Well, a lot of people don't know that technique. Well, the advanced program, we show firefighters on how to partially doff their SCBA, how to slack their pack, how to perform a left side anchor versus a right side anchor deployment, and negotiate that window. Typically, for me, the way my gear is set up, I can negotiate a smaller opening, placing the hook on my left, and doing what I call a right side rollout, easier than if I place the hook on my right or hold it with my right hand and I do a left side rollout. Well, I was showing both at a window that was about 13.5 inches wide, 14 inches, I think, which is less than the opening of a stud space. You know, studs being 16 on center, right? That gives you about a 14.5 inch opening. In theory, you should really never have a window smaller than that, but it's a confidence builder. If you can do that, you know what your limitations are. I've done it many, many times, Kelly. We used to incorporate bailouts in a firefighter training circuit that we would have. We'd have a obstacle course we'd go through for cardiovascular training, and in the midst of that course, you'd have to perform a bailout. And I had that set up. I did it many times. I just happened to be out there. It was cold. I didn't have any warm ups. And I was negotiating a more difficult dismount. I did the left side first, and now I was doing the right side hook and left side rollout. And I was halfway out, and my bicep tendon on my right arm popped, and I blew that off the bone. And it was there's some techniques, some lessons learned that came out of it. A bunch of things that I don't think we had the time to go in to share, but. It was unfortunately a pretty devastating injury. It was about a 4 to 6 month recovery, but that was the worst injury I ever sustained. And the other one I wasn't involved in, but I heard of was during a class we were teaching, one of our instructors wasn't performing a belay properly and had too much slack in the line. And we're very particular on that, keeping the belay tensioned because of that drop factor. And they were doing a different technique, and they dropped, and that load, that shock load on the system, ended up dislocating their shoulder. But that was an instructor error. But those are the two serious ones that I was involved in that I heard of. It's let's face
sure,
it, man.
Leroy, any? Sorry, go ahead, Dale.
Go ahead, Leroy. Take over, man.
any injuries to you, or like, you know, common injuries you see? You're definitely man about town or about the country. Yep. So.
Yeah, I mean, the ones you see most common are the ones that Dale describes, you know, the bicep yep. tendons, because people don't understand, even with a remote anchor, it's like, dude, you have a belay line, you can't fall. It's physically impossible. Sure. You can't go sure. anywhere. But you have people that get that death grip on the sit yeah. plate. I mean, that screwed up my shoulders plenty yep. doing it. It just kind of comes with the territory. Probably the worst one that I have heard of as far as an injury, it was a career-ending injury. Belay guy was asleep at the switch, big fire department. And they do their required training yeah. annually. They require the guys to, you know, prove competency on an annual basis. Belay guy happened to be asleep at the switch. Young kid, 2 years, I think he was on the job, maybe two and a half years on the job. And they were belaying on the backside of an escape belt, like in the, so that the belay wasn't in the way. You know what's going to happen.
Fold like a taco.
Yeah. Right? They folded him in half, but the biggest thing is because there was so much slack in the belay. It would have been one thing if it would have been sure, tight. Yeah. But there was so much slack in the belay that, and he generated a significant amount of speed before the belay line locked yeah. on it. It actually transected his lower spine, his lumbar spine.
Oh, wow.
You know what that means?
Ended his... Bad. It literally dislocated three vertebrae in his lumbar spine. Gross. Ended his yeah. career. He complained. He got back to the station. He was ambulatory. Got back to the station. Said, you know, I think I really screwed up my back. Yeah. And, you know, went to his company officer. Said, boss, you know, I really screwed up my back here. And they took him in and... he got to the point where he couldn't hardly walk anymore because his legs were tingling from all of the swelling in his spinal column. But it literally ended his career. It ruptured two of the discs and a couple of the vertebrae themselves literally disintegrated the base. That's the worst one I've ever heard of.
Yeah, pretty bad. Transected spine. That seems like a winner and not in a good way. I know we've been using like fall pro harnesses, you know, with just the dorsal D attachment and like not even great ones. I mean, they're rated, but like, you know, where I'm at, we buy them from the Home Depot fall pro bucket kit, you know, and they slide on mm-hmm. over firefighting gear super easy. And it's a dorsal belay. It works well. You know, I try not to have my guys wearing firefighting helmets to initially practice because, you know, that back brim. Definitely, right. You know, wants to jam their neck forward if the belay catches. But Dale, what are you guys using? I know you've got some videos on the improvised webbing harness. Yeah.
Yeah. It's my injury actually happened on the bailout wall. Again, we use that as our starting point, you know, walk before you can kind of, or crawl before you start walking. And you know, anytime you do something challenging, sure. it worked well, but it was, you know, it just goes to show you, I think one of the things I guess people can take away from this is that you don't want to literally just jump into this, no pun intended. You got to do your research. You got to get in touch with, again, Leroy for us was instrumental. You know, before I got in touch with you, Kelly, he was our rope guru in the area and has been a tremendous asset from the bailout standpoint, but just even our special ops training. But anyway, you know, we realized that, you got to look at all the techniques. You got to have an instructor that's knowledgeable in the game, somebody that isn't going to fall asleep at the wheel, like Leroy stated, somebody that knows, that's certified on how to belay. And what we tried to do is just put components together that were going to work for us. And going into commercially made harnesses, full body harnesses is the best way to go, especially when you look at somebody going inverted. There's no possibility of tearing off a belt, you know, pulling off a seat harness. It's capturing the shoulders and upper torso. So we came up with Webbing. We basically just call it a full body hasty harness. And there's a couple different ways that we can configure or rig it, depending on, you know, what type of belay we're going to do, where we're going to attach. But that works well for us. It's typically we have them anywhere from a nine foot loop up to about a 12 foot loop, which is made either from a 20 foot length of 1-inch tubular or a 25 foot length of 1-inch tubular. And it's worked well for us. You can actually put it over your gear, put your SCBA over the top of that, and it isn't going anywhere. If you're just starting out without an SCBA on, you can put it on and then put your coat on over it to kind of hold it in place. I can't tell you how many people that we've safely arrested a potential serious injury or fatal fall with that setup once we've gone elevated. And it's a key component, but you got to know what you're doing. You got to know your belay system, how to operate it, how to staff it. And definitely having safety measures in place is huge, because you can do everything right, and again, something can still go wrong. Leroy said, some people it's, you know, not trusting the system, over tensioning. For me, it was negotiating a very, very difficult opening. You know, the more challenging to make it, the more potential there is for something to go wrong. So
definitely. I mean, and that just come, you know, it's pushing your limit and being the progressive guy who's, you know, trying to figure out the limit of, you know, their abilities and their system's abilities. I know from a belay standpoint, I'm definitely a fan of an exterior belay, you know, with a high change of direction above.
Yeah,
that's your belay operator standing on the ground outside.
Yep.
Okay, and that's generally what you guys try to do. Yeah, Dale.
Yeah, if we can have that elevated anchor point, and if that student would make a mistake, or again, worst case scenario, a system component would fail, which is highly unlikely nowadays.
Yep.
But you want to swing them away from their egress point. You want to swing them away from the wall, from the window. Like you guys were referring to, some people attaching to the back of a harness at waist level, so it's not in their way. That's a potential cardinal sin. Folding them like a taco, slamming their head into the face of the building or the wall. You want them to pull away from that. And I think there's a lot of components that people don't really understand, Kelly. And that's where CMC and a lot of these rope rescue manufacturers and companies that provide training become instrumental, because it's guys like yourself and Leroy who have done this countless times and do it at a professional level that can educate people on how to do this right, how to set up their training facility to facilitate proper, safe, efficient, effective training. And not just watch a YouTube video. I'm not trying to sell myself short, but there's a lot of things that you don't see, right? A lot of mistakes that were made to get to that point of that final product or that final video that we don't always have the time to show. So make sure you do your research. If you're buying into this concept, you're going to get a system, do your research, make sure you're ready to train properly and safely. That's an element that can't be underemphasized.
No, I agree. I don't think it can. Don't sell yourself short, because your YouTube videos have like just tons of killer stuff in it. Like, you know, we still stand watch in my fire department, you know, all night long, somebody's sitting up. And I mean, I've watched your videos at the, you know, 2 and 3 in the morning on watch. And it's, you know, kept me as awake as I can be. And
I thought you were going to say, but you're right.
There's a lot of. No. I'll tell you that after the podcast. Geez,
man, I got to put on one of Peckle's YouTube videos. That'll do it.
Put on Dale, man. Like this. No. There's just loads of good information on there. I mean, you shouldn't sell it short, but you're right. There's a lot of finer points that a YouTube video, you know, can't tell you. Like, oh, hey, man, try it this way. You know, you mentioned a word, Dale, research, which is interesting, and like. It's kind of a, I don't know, like it's a nerd word, right? Like, who thinks of research and firefighting and bailout stuff? I'm a big fan. You know, I am a rope geek, and I go to the International Technical Rescue Symposium every year, as does Leroy, who runs the hospitality suite and is responsible for all the beer there. But there's a lot of good research out there. From the International Technical Rescue Symposium. Again, I know somebody prompted me to do my bailout presentation, and he said, like, hey, man, I bet the mountain guys would be cool with this. Like, you know, East Coast firefighter, you know, or big city firefighter, you know, we're half inch rope, you know, two steel carabiner type of guys in general, but you know, like marginal anchor kind of stuff and really small diameter rope. Like this guy said, I bet the mountain guys would get a kick out of it. So, you know, that prompted me to do my presentation in 2010 called The Defenestration Sensation. And I did, you know, I just did a bunch of research on hooks and devices and kits and techniques and history. But after that, you know, a couple of people have done some interesting testing in 2016. Mike Forbes from Spokane Fire, who's been on the podcast before, and Matt Hunt from Sterling Rope, they co-presented the impact of extreme fire behavior on firefighter escape systems. Like they set up an oven and tried to burn hooks and fire-resistant rope. And like the short version of it is like, it's all fine. Like any like Technora, you know, fire resistant type of rope, it took 9 minutes to burn through and like, you know, flashover type conditions. And the hooks were fine to, you know, you know, 2,500 pounds after 9 minutes of, you know, direct fire. And then somebody from CMC presented in 2017 on, is my escape line still safe after, I forget what the follow-up, like, is my escape line still safe after, what, you know, a bunch of descents or fire? Do you remember that presentation or remember who did that?
Yeah, that was put together. It was actually based on a question that somebody had asked of the instructors. And I got a phone call and the guy said, hey, we've done this with our escape system. How many more rappels can I do? And I'm like, I don't know you and I don't know the answer. But I know a guy who can do some research. So it was actually Ole, one of our engineers, sat down and figured out, took the radius of the device that the guy was using, ran multiple tests of different types of escape line, 100% Technora, Technora over nylon, 100% poly over nylon, multiple times, and then see how much strength was actually left. And like you would figure, the poly over nylon lasted the longest. Unfortunately, it's also the same, or maintained the most strength. It's also the same one that's got the lowest melting temperature. You know, unfortunately. Yeah. But I was really surprised at how rapidly the strength drop off took place, and it kind of hit this plateau. Yeah. And what they were looking at is a direct comparison to the Technora webbing. Yeah. And the webbing, I mean, you get this little bit of a drop off and then it just stays at that strength, like to 500 past 500 cycles. It just doesn't drop off because it's so malleable. Like you'd figure it's malleable to begin with. That's what actually prompted the test.
Right on. Just a random question to the instructor.
Yeah. Yeah. Just a random question that the guy called me up and asked me this question. And that's actually where a lot of our research comes from, is people who call us up and say, hey, what about this? Dude, I never thought of that.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, research, again, sounds like such a nerd word. But like, you know, what, I guess one of the guys from Mythbusters says, you know, the difference between science and messing around is if you write it down or not. You know, that's like I think there's some truth in that. And I know when I was doing my, you know, research for my presentation, like I wanted to test anchors, you know, what different anchoring options for bailout. So, you know, one of the things we did was just spike a Halligan bar in a hardwood floor, like just, you know, just swing a Halligan bar into the floor. And then we pulled on it with an Aztec kit and measured it with the dynamometer. And we couldn't get enough pull on it to make it fail. And, you know, that was research to us, you know, like, the number was, you know, over 850 pounds. Like we could pull the 850 and couldn't pull no more. And then we're like, all right, that's, you know, that's pretty good. And then we tried putting two people on it, you know, a foot off the ground and, you know, bouncing on it. It's like, oh, well, holy crap. But you know, that's good too. And I think research is it shouldn't be a frowned upon word, although I think it is sometimes, but you know, one of the things we discovered doing our research was, you know, turns in rope, like around walls and edges, has a huge impact. Like, it, you know, if it would cause you grief raising somebody in a rope rescue world, it's going to be the most favorable thing you can do for your bailout kit or for your bailout, you know, just escape. And one of the things I do is just run rope around as many edges as I can. You know, if you can run a, if you can anchor in one room and escape out of another, you know, run your rope around a wall through two turns, like you've cut like, you know, 80% of the force to your anchor or something. It's just, it's a ridiculous number. And I don't know if Dale, either you or Leroy have messed with that. Like usually we anchor at the windowsill or anchor in the room we're in, but have you messed around at all with, you know, anchoring and running your rope like around edges or around corners? Cause that cuts off a crazy amount of force on the anchor.
Yeah. We've actually played with it a couple of times. Well, in the East Coast department that I was just at, that was a question that they had. And I go, you have no idea how much strain it is going to take off of the anchor when you, the more edges you incorporate, the less likely your anchor is to decide to chase you out the window. You know, it's always a bad plan to have your anchor pass you up on the way down.
The worst.
it's just a bad thing. I mean, and I tell people all the time, same thing as what you say is, to me, the absolute worst place to be placing that hook is at the windowsill. There are a multitude of better options that you have that if, I mean, let's face it, because you're going to bail out, ain't a surprise.
Right. Yeah.
You know, it's like, ooh, it's hot. Oh, I think I can take it a little bit more. It's like, no, you really can't.
Time's up.
And so, you know, it's not a surprise to think that the conditions are getting worse. And hopefully at that before, like you said before, you know, sometimes the fires just don't go out. And I agree, you put the fire out, the problem goes away. But there are times where things happen. But we did play around with it at the same department, kicking a hole in the wall, in a like an intersecting wall. And then running the rope, they wanted to play with it, running a rope through a couple of stud spaces. I go, you would never do that in that case. So, but you take it, hooking it around the bottom of the stud, you make that first turn at the windowsill and the second turn on the outside of the sill. We had guys hanging out the window. You could walk up and wiggle around where they had shoved their hook with the guy hanging on it.
Totally. Dale, you ever messed around with like just running your escape rope around corners to scrub off the tension on the anchor?
Unfortunately, I don't have access to a lot of things that you guys do as far as to do, you know, legitimate load testing to evaluate just loads that are placed on the system, loads that are placed on the rope. I kind of wish I did, but so it is a lot of it is trial and error for us. We always talk about substantial object first, Kelly, you know, being your best option, you know, just like you look at like a tensionless hitch, right? You know, full string tie offs.
Yeah.
Those are an advantage. But I always try to promote the closer that you can establish your anchor near your exit point, the better off you are, just because if conditions are deteriorating and you're tying off 10, 15 feet away, there's a possibility that you could lose reference to your exit. It is more time consuming. You may not be on the other end of that room when things are going bad. Hopefully you're by the window. But just like Leroy hit, I think probably the biggest one that we try to promote is substantial object first. Then we move to what we refer to as a tool and wall technique, if it's viable with the construction features that are present. Tool in the corner of the window or across the sill plate. And then your last resort, as both you guys touched on, was placing that hook at the window. Just because it's a single point, right? Let's face it. Whether you got a projected sill plate or not, it's just a single point of contact, and you have to maintain that friction and tension control discipline as you negotiate the sill. So if you can wrap around something, for sure. And I think what Leroy touched on is the one we probably promote the most, is try to find an L wall, a partition wall that's, you know, close by, immediately adjacent to your window. A lot of times that might be closer than the window or the wall across the room. But then it gets your rope closer to your exit point, maximizes the length of rappel. If you don't have some of the Kevlar or Aramid fiber rope and you're old school and you have a piece of nylon, again, you're minimizing the section that exposed to heat or fire. But that's our progression. And usually we do the same thing. We breach the wall because how much time do you have? Breach the wall, wrap a single stud, and then off you go. If you can do that, that's one of your best bets. If you got a king size bed, maybe queen size, something's heavy, that's gonna hold the weight of one person. And wrapping the base of those, we've done that. Radiators, anything close by, those are the things that we look as our bomb-proof anchors, and doing that wrap. And now, again, we look at the evolutions of these systems. Now with, again, CMC's latest flash G with the gated technology, you can hook into those systems even if you do a couple wraps and then clip in the hook, literally lightning fast, you know?
Definitely. And I think, you know, again, it comes from, you know, just messing around in like acquired structures or vacants. You know, one of the things I've always liked to do is, you know, have people pick, you know, the crappiest anchor they can find. And basically, you know, anchor off to the sketchiest thing and then, you know, walk downstairs outside of the building and hook up to their system, you know, 6 inches or a foot from the ground.
Yeah, right.
And
yeah,
just bounce on it, basically.
Yep, that's what we've done. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so you know your left and right boundaries then, you know, obviously you got, you know, if you wrap a column, it's going to be bomb proof. If you do, you know, this or that, it's going to be bomb proof. But, you know, what's the other boundary? What's not bomb proof? What is the sketchiest thing you can anchor to and still make it work? And I think just figuring that out in the real world is probably the most important thing you can do in regards to anchor selection. Like what is actually going to hold you?
Right.
If it doesn't hold, like that. Your alternative was burning to death.
Right. Right. So, exactly.
Say that again. I talked right. Yeah. So, I think that's, I think it's important, you know, obviously to train in your actual location. So, final note I've got here, like what's the future of escape systems? You know, like, I don't even have a good answer for that question and I don't know what it is. I know, you know, the transition from, you know, a loop on the end of your rope to a carabiner to a hook, you know, that like the hook is the thing. It still is the thing. Descent control devices have slowly gotten better. You know, I want to wear what's best for me. Like I want to come home to my wife and kids at night. There's a lot of good ones out there. I'm using the lever now. I definitely am I'm a CMC guy, but, I think that gives me the best shot at, you know, my device clearing the windowsill and, or, you know, plowing through anything in the way. But what is the future? What's the improvement? Is it anchoring technology? Is it descent? Is it rope? Leroy, we'll start with you on this last topic.
That is a really good question. And I don't have an answer. That's kind of how I live life. I don't
welcome to the club.
I don't have an answer. I don't have an answer. I think, to be honest with you, I think stuff is going to get smaller, lighter. Would not surprise me. I think the hardest thing to change would be the anchor. What are you going to use? What takes the place of a hook? You know, because dimensionally, you really can't get a ton smaller. Profile wise, I think the smallest one that's out there would be like the Crosby, you know, as far as overall profile of the hook. But how much smaller can you get with the primary part of the system? Ropes. I mean, we tested, and this is back in 99, tested a bailout system with 4 millimeter. It's kind of exciting.
Oh, yeah.
And no belay.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, which was like stupid on so many levels. Now, granted, we didn't have a lot of elevation, and there was an old rotten mattress that we found for an impact pad. But it was one of those things where how small can you go and still be comfortable? Now, it wasn't a standard 4 millimeter shoelace, right? It wasn't 550 cord, but it was about that size, and it was blended material. But the problem with it was that with fire gloves on, you had to stare at your hand because you didn't know it was even in your hand. That's kind of, you know, that's pushing a little bit too far, I think, if you still have to have tail hand discipline, which I think maybe the devices will change and you won't need to have that second hand on the rope or whatever you want to call it.
No, you're right. I remember trying some 5mm, is it Vectra, I think it's called? Technora, whatever. Like, I was like, holy crap, this stuff's rated to 6,000 pounds. It's tiny. So I ran it through my escape artist descender. I hit the lever and freaking went right to the ground. I'm like, okay. It's not my hobble restraints on my Vortex, but like I thought small and strong was good. But it turns out that the friction coefficient was a little, it had nothing to do with my weight. It was all the friction coefficient of the cordage in the device.
They do correspond to each other. Just in case you were wondering, your weight and friction coefficient.
Nah, I don't believe it. I'll have to do some more research. Research is for nerds. I'm not even going to research it. Dale, your thoughts, future of escape systems, like what do you see as the next?
It's funny. I pose that question to Leroy on more than one occasion, just because of I push the systems at the vocational level, privately in the classes I teach, but also when we looked at evolving on my volunteer paid on call department, my crew department. What's next? I'm a big gearhead. I'm not ashamed to admit it. I'm a gearhead. I'm a gear junkie. I'm always looking for the latest and greatest. I know, guys, we talk about compound bowls. What's the next evolution for compound bowls? How much faster are they going to get? How much lighter are they going to get? It's like anything else. And I know Leroy's touched on it. It's, you guys are in, research, R&D, research and development. With CMC and on your own, I did the same thing. We played around with 5mm, basically like a Kevlar Technora, did basically a shoelace on a friction controlled descender. And as Leroy touched on, you can wrap it around your DCD multiple times like a Mini 8, but you're not feeling it. So there is a point where size does matter. You can get too small. We're always trying to get lighter weight, more compact. I'm gonna blow smoke your guys' way, CMC. I think they're the forerunners in it. I really do. And this is coming from a guy, mind you, that when I teach on the vocational level, even a private level, I try to tell people, listen, I'm gonna try to show you everything. Okay, there's a ton of different hooks on the market. There's a lot of different rope on the market. There's a lot of different descenders on the market. Everyone has their personal preference. They all have their pros and cons, their positive and negative elements. You need to try them to see what you want. But if you want my personal opinion, I'm going to tell you what I carry. And I tell people I've moved to the lever, the CMC lever system. I think with the proprietary webbing that you guys have, the packability of that webbing, the strength of that webbing, the durability of that webbing, the heat temp, it far exceeds most of everything that's on the market. That with the lever descender, in my opinion, there is not a better descender on the market right now. It's so intuitive, easy to use. And then you guys, you evolve to the new system with the carabiner integrated on the terminal end. I think the big evolution, you guys are taking it there. Leroy has always said this, yeah. Hey, we're trying to make it lighter weight, more versatile. The strengths of the aluminum now, it's freakish. I mean, the Crosby's great. It's a small hook. It's versatile, but you don't have a hitching slot on it. And it's steel. It's heavy. You look at the new Flash 2 and the Flash G. I mean, they're super lightweight, extremely strong. There's that parameter of spine to point displacement or distance. That's important, in my opinion. You can go too large, but you can have it too narrow, right? So there's so many variables to think about. I agree with you and Leroy. I don't think you can go really any smaller than webbing. I really don't think you can. I think that's a happy medium. Bags and how you pack your system, that's one thing that you need to address, that firefighters need to look at. Hey, there's pros and cons and how you carry your system. And you have to look at your own turnout gear and how you operate and function as your department. But the components, I don't see them getting much smaller. I mean, Leroy, Kelly, you guys would know better than me. I think we've kind of almost reached that limit unless we come up with some space age alien that comes down and we determine a new age metal that can be even lighter weight. and thinner and super strong. I think we're at the edge of that. I think the thing is finding a system that's going to allow you to deploy your setup in the fastest, most efficient means possible. And when you start looking at these systems from a, I like to promote it as a VRS, which is a term that I guess kind of came up with, because I don't like to look at them as one-dimensional tools or pieces of equipment just used to self-rescue or just used as a personal safety system or a personal escape or bailout kit. I look at it as a versatile rescue system. Kelly, you touched base on it. I mean, you can use it for below grade extraction. Yeah. You can use it for elevated anchor points. Again, the strength of these systems is crazy. Leroy touched on it. The webbing is probably one of the most durable. But I see so many different setups, Kelly, on how people store their system, and they don't really look at the pros and cons of that. They're like, this is how I'm going to keep it. But you can set up a lumbar bag, and that might be better for you. Putting your system in your pocket is a setup for what I call reverse deployment. So you can set it up for primary and also reverse your system. The lever DCD allows you to do that. Understanding, I think, what each component can do for you. And I don't know. I wish I had the answer, because I'm like, do I want to spend $450 and then in 5 years or 3 years, there's something even better? I think that's always going to be the case. I don't know where that ends, but I can tell you from being in this game for a long time, I think what you guys have right now, it's one of the best out there. It's just, I think the bags is storage is the next thing to address and how you carry it, because the bag and the pouch can take up weight and space as well. Trying to perfect that and mirror that storage system with the type of system you have is something that I don't think a lot of people are looking at yet.
No, I agree with you. I'm a lumbar bag guy on a belt. I thought it was going to feel like wearing a saggy diaper, although I don't have any experience with that either. But like, I think it seems like it would feel like that, but it was, but you're right. I think the overarching thing now is just like having people be comfortable with whatever system they choose and knowing, again, the limits of their system and just their ability to deploy it. Yeah. I think you're right, Dale. I think at least as far as, software goes, we've always been at the small end of things, but now it's durable and fire resistant, and any smaller and you just can't feel it through your firefighting gloves.
Yeah.
And you just can't get a good grip on it through your firefighting gloves.
And listen, so I think Leroy hit on it, Kelly. That's fine. I mean, with the lever, we've done it. We've done single one-handed rappels with it. I can't say enough about it. I mean, I think it's freaking awesome. And I've tried pretty much them all, just like you guys have. But it's your technique, the burn technique, and you're running that rope through the hitching slot. You're holding onto that rope. You want to feel for that rope or that webbing, and you can still feel it.
Sure,
you can still feel. You can still feel the web, and I think that's a huge component. So how small can you go there? I think you found it already. I think we're there.
I agree.
Yeah,
I definitely agree. Who knows future of escape systems? Who knows? Like it's always it'll probably always be a question mark until the next aha moment, and it's gonna come from some dude jumping out of a window in some department, and with the suggestion like, man, why not this? And
right.
Holy crap. Why didn't we cut the corners off our square and make it a wheel? Like, I don't know. Like, that sounds like a great idea. I think that's, who knows? Like it'll probably come by accident, and it's probably going to come by some firefighter trying to solve a problem that, nobody else thought to solve, which is kind of how all of this comes about.
Right.
Concluding this, I thank you, Dale, for being on the podcast here, and I just can't thank you enough for all of the quality content you've put out on YouTube. And I know, I know there was a ton of work that went into that, and there's just a ton of great information, and to just put it out there like that, it's much appreciated. It's made a humongous impact, and you've got a you know, you've got some serious credibility when it comes to the firefighter safety and rescue and bailout stuff. So,
well, I appreciate that,
thank
brother.
Thank you for joining us.
It's been an honor and a pleasure, you know, being on the podcast. You know, you and Leroy have been huge influences on me, whether you realize it or not. You know, I've always tried to keep up with a lot of the rope rescue manufacturers, but CMC has always been there for me, and they've always gone above and beyond. So definitely a plug your guys' way. It's a topic I'm really passionate about. My dad was in charge of a fire where he lost two of his friends that were firefighter paramedics at the time. He was the battalion chief in charge of that fire, and they died on his watch. And I was old enough to remember that incident, and it stuck with me. And that was I knew when I became a firefighter that was one of the things that I was gonna research. Okay. I know we use that as a negative term, but it isn't. It's a positive term. And it was one of the things that I'm like, hey, what can I do to make our brothers and sisters safer, to help ensure they go home safe and sound to their families the next day, but also allow them to do their job the way we're expected to do it. Okay. We're not expected to play it safe and cut corners. We're expected to make the grab. We're expected to push the envelope and save lives, even at great risk to our own. But if there's things that we can do that can increase our safety margins, then let's do it. Why not? You know, that's part of being progressive and smart. It's called intelligent aggressiveness. And these systems, they make you your pre-deployed, your frontline RIT, as you mentioned. You know, they put you in the game, in the trenches, ready to handle a lot of different types of situations. So hopefully, you know, we can keep it going. We can get the word out, and you know, getting the cost down would be great. But again, whatever you get, whatever type of system you invest in, make sure you invest time in it as well, and train with it properly and a lot. And if you have the ability, get yourself training systems, invest with a couple firefighters and get a trainer that you can just beat up and keep your frontline system in, you know, more virgin, unused condition. I think it's still an element that we need to educate people on, Kelly. I still come across a lot of people, and I think Leroy, you probably even more so because you travel the world, that the concept of these systems is still in their infancy, I think. I mean, am I correct? New York is still the only one that has a state law on it.
Yeah, I think they're the only ones with the state law. And I think, you know, I hope people will see the usefulness to it. And like, I think your summation of all that is like, I couldn't put it any better myself. And I don't think I'm going to try. Leroy, you, I mean, that was a hell of a wrap up from Dale.
Yeah, I have absolutely nothing to add to that. Is going to add anything to that. In fact, any comments that I could make right now is going to make us all dumb.
There's an excellent line from Billy Madison about that. Yeah, no. Awesome. I mean, Dale, thank you, Leroy. Thank you for joining us on this podcast. If any of you listening have any questions, Dale gave his email out. Super generous dude, amazing amount of content, who's probably made more difference to more firefighters than he'll ever know. We'll catch you on the next one. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, brothers.
All right. Yeah, thanks. All right.